Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we talk about the skies, the night sky. Tell you what, nothing gives you more, I think, a sense of perspective than looking up at the night sky. It really puts you in your place in the best possible way, I think. We are going to talk about astronomy today, and whether you're ready for your first experience or you've been studying it for your whole life, I think you're going to enjoy hearing from our guest. Jim Lattice, faculty associate in the astronomy department at UW-Madison, directs the UW Space Place. And Jim, always great to have you with us.
Glad to be here, Dollar.
And Tom Hall. Tom is an optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. And Tom, welcome back. Great to have you with us as well.
Hi, Larry.
We have lots we can talk about. You may have some questions of your own as you listen in. Are you a stargazer? How'd you get started? Do you have a favorite place to watch? Questions about optics, telescopes, or binoculars? I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question there. And if you've got a kind of a cool night sky photo, put that up there too as well. What, you know, a triple black hole was recently discovered, Jim. And I guess it's a pretty amazing thing. First, what is a black hole?
Well, okay, yeah. So these are triple massive, supermassive, they usually call them black holes, that are typically millions and millions of times more massive than the sun. There are also smaller black holes that are something like the mass of a star in that neighborhood, or a few times the mass of the star. And so those are really different, very different animals. A huge supermassive black star is what you find at the center of most galaxies. This is something that's just become clear in the last, I don't know, decade or so, that every time you look at a massive galaxy, you find a massive black hole at the center of the galaxy. And even more curious, when you can measure the mass of that black hole, you find that it scales with the mass of the galaxy. There's a rough proportionality. So a galaxy that's twice as massive as another will have a black hole that's like twice as massive as the other. So there's an as yet unknown mechanism going on that somehow links the development of galaxies and supermassive black holes and galaxies. Mm-hmm. So that's been around for a bit. And we also know that galaxies merge. We see that happening all the time, that galaxies interact and merge and form then a larger galaxy. So people have figured, well, those black holes have to be part of this merger process. But what exactly happens to them is not at all clear. For example, our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, and the Andromeda galaxy will one day merge and become a larger galaxy. And the Andromeda galaxy has one or possibly two massive black holes, and we have one massive black hole at the center of ours. So these kinds of things were expected, but nobody had actually seen a galaxy yet where you could actually pick out the individual supermassive black holes. So it kind of looks like this must be a product of a one or more merger events.
Okay.
Right. And so these black holes kind of find themselves to the end up in the centers of these galaxies. But after that, just what happens to them is not entirely clear. Presumably black holes can merge, but nobody really knows what would happen if two supermassive black holes merge. What kind of fireworks might that produce? One thing that's exciting about it is that they might produce gravitational waves. If anything in the universe would produce gravitational waves, the merger of supermassive black holes ought to do it. But gravity waves, we've been looking for gravity waves in the universe for some time now and not found any good evidence of them, although a lot of people say we haven't built the right instruments yet, which is probably true. But those are a potential source of powerful gravitational waves that we could then detect, which would be a consequence of general relativity, of Einstein's general relativity, that an event like that should produce gravity waves. So, but nobody knows whether these things actually merge or how they merge very effectively either, because a black hole orbiting around in the center of a galaxy, or two black holes, imagine just two black holes orbiting each other, they have to give up a lot of energy to merge, just just like a planet orbiting the sun. Mm-hmm. It's stable. The Earth is orbiting the sun, and it's not going to spiral into the sun unless something causes the system to give up a lot of energy. Like if the Earth interacted with Jupiter and gave up a lot of energy to it in some way, then you could imagine the Earth and the sun merging or something like that. If you've just got two supermassive black holes, there's got to be some way that that system can lose energy and so that the orbits decay and they spiral in and approach each other. So it's not clear what mechanism that would be. So they might be stable for very, very long periods of time unless there's something else going on. Now, three gives you lots more opportunities for interesting interactions. So something could happen. They could kick out one of those black holes, maybe, and the other two could merge or something like that. But then you've got the prospect of this third supermassive black hole doing what? I don't know. So it's all kinds of intriguing possibilities, but not a lot of answers of what's going on in there.
That's really interesting. I'm wondering, speaking of interesting, what's interesting, and maybe Tom, you can join in on this too, in terms of the sky in the next month or so. What's going on out there?
Well, we've got the nice lunar eclipse coming up in October, except I think it's going to be daytime here for that. And then there's that business about the supermoon.
Mm-hmm.
I just wrote up a little something about that. You hear a lot of, I don't know, what shall we call it? Media hype. We used to just call it a full moon, but this full moon is... occurs near perigee, which means that it's closest to the Earth, and so it appears larger in the sky. But it turns out it doesn't appear much larger in the sky, just a little bit.
Just a little.
And you wouldn't even notice it unless you had one of those other full moons right beside it that mm-hmm. in previous months that are not so close. So anyway, I worry about people getting all excited about the supermoon and then going out and they say, oh, I've seen that before. That's the full moon.
You know what's kind of interesting to me is sometimes when you're watching, Tom, you can maybe comment on this, when you're watching a football game and it's a night game and it's a stadium outside, they'll train sometimes, at some point, if the moon is in sight, they'll train the camera on the moon and then zoom in, and they can get a pretty darn good shot of the moon.
The television cameras these days can hit about 20 power sometimes, and you find that in even beginner telescopes. The moon at 20 power looks great. It really does.
Yeah, that's small for a telescope. 20 is not a lot for a typical telescope. So.
And even in binoculars, then, it may not fill your field of view, but if you get it a quarter size of your field that you're looking at, that's a lot of detail. It really looks nice. And yeah, those camera guys, they've got some pretty nice equipment these days. And 20 power in television is... very strong. They need really stable platforms, and because you really notice a shake. And
Yeah,
all the things we deal with telescopes, a telescope at 50 or 60 power, even though that's real typical, any kind of little shake in the mounting or the system is really irritating.
Well, you know, and I am a football fan, but when they zoom in, I always want to say, don't go away. Hold on for a little bit longer. Let us look.
I don't know if anybody watched the World Cup, but they had a great shot of the sun setting
in the
arms of the statue.
That's right.
And that was just fabulous. It you know, matched the head like a halo, and they were able to zoom in and zoom back out. Great point of view. Some director was doing his job there.
Yeah, that was an amazing shot.
Well, Bob in Washington Island has a question. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me on. We appreciate your show. We never miss it. I have a pair of binoculars. They're LEITZ.
Oh, sure. Lights.
And I've had them for a long, long time, and
you sure have.
Increasing. They're a travenoid 10 times 40, and I just wondered where I could get them cleaned or repaired.
Are they out of focus, or what's the, when you talk about repair, what is the repair issue?
Well, on one of the sides, there's a little black thing hangs down, and they just don't seem as sharp as they used to be.
A black thing hangs down as you're looking through them, you mean? It's in your field of view? Gotcha.
Yes, it's inside, but it's a tiny, like a little piece of dust or something.
Yeah.
And the rubber on the viewing stand of them is very deteriorated.
Yeah. Well, the company is still current. That is Leica camera, L-E-I-C-A, is the current spelling they'll use on their equipment that they export. And Leica would indeed probably have repair parts or have a repair tech. They're on the East Coast. I forget where in New Jersey their repair facilities currently are. But you might be shocked or surprised that they would even have spare parts or be able to certainly break into that binocular and take the piece out of the field of view. If you see things as you're looking through them, there can only be really one spot. That's right in the eyepiece. They can screw those off and make sure they redo the seals for the waterproofing. They're very fine binoculars. I'm sure you have held on to them because the equipment, even from the lights, 30 years ago or so, were premium German binoculars. They would be worth redoing or working on.
Okay, yeah, when I was a young man, I saved up. I read that they were a great binocular, and so I saved up and bought them. And actually, I've had them stolen twice, but once on a sailboat in the Caribbean and once out of my luggage.
And you got them back?
No.
Oh, I see.
I continued to buy them.
I see. There you go.
But yeah, they're a nice piece. But just look up Leica camera. I would hit their website. They'll have a repair tag in there somewhere or a contact number that you could contact them for repair.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, another comment. I'm a retired pilot, and I used to fly back and forth from the East Coast, and it was a Learjet, so we could get up in the high 40s. And I loved to turn off all the lights in the cockpit and then lean up and look out the window at night. And because you're above, all the haze, you're above everything, and it's so beautiful.
Oh, man, you got three envious guys sitting here saying, oh, man.
Yeah, you can turn the direction you want to go if you're flying the plane. Yeah. Let's look south.
You're probably above, half the atmosphere, 40,000 feet easily.
I would think, yeah.
You're above half at 18,000.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
We're up around above 90%.
Wow. There you go.
Oh, man.
Totally told me. But nice. Yeah, it was spectacular, and I kept hoping to see something unusual. I would see, the meteors and that type of thing. But, no UFOs.
Well, Bob, I really enjoyed your call. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. He mentioned meteors, and many of us look forward to the Perseid meteor showers every year. This year it's going to be August 10th through the 13th.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, right during that super moon that we were just talking about.
Oh, sure,
of course. Yeah, I'm sorry, this is not a very good year for the Perseids. You can certainly still go look for them. You can get out there, try to find yourself a spot maybe where the moon is behind you. Later in the evening when that full moon is on over into the western half of the sky, and the meteors, the Perseus, the radiant point of the meteors comes up in the east later at night. So the best thing to do is try to arrange it so that the moon is behind you and you're looking east. Mm-hmm. Maybe you've got a building or something you can use to block some moonlight. That's about the best you can do for a moonlit meteor shower.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. And I mean, that's not to say that it isn't worth, taking a look or something, but you just won't see as many meteors as you would when we have a dark, when we have a good one.
Jim Lattice of the Astronomy Department at UW-Madison, Director of the UW Space Place, and Tom Hall of Eagle Optics, our guests today here on the Ideas Network. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're finding out what to look for in the Wisconsin night sky with Jim Lattice and Tom Hall. You can join us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. I'd certainly love to hear from you. Let's talk a little bit more about the night sky. What else are we going to see out there?
Well, so we've got two bright planets in the night sky right now, Saturn and Mars. And these days, if you go out and look over sort of in the southwest, depends on what time of night you go out, south to southwest, there's a bright star overhead called Arcturus that'll be a little bit to the west, western half of the sky. And below it are two bright objects, which are Mars and Saturn. Saturn's on the left as you're looking at it. Mars on the right, more to the west, to the right. But over the next month or so, Mars is going to move considerably, as it does really pretty much all the time. But it's going to move right over there by Saturn by the end of August. Last week or so of August, 22nd, 23rd, somewhere along in there. Mars is going to be over that triangle is going to get real narrow at the base.
Okay.
And they're going to come together that should be a really nice sight by the end of August to see those two fairly bright planets, roughly the same brightness over there, and a great time to get out a little telescope if you've got a telescope to look at Saturn. I don't know exactly how close they're going to get, probably not close enough to get them both in a telescope field. I doubt they'll be that close. But it's a good time to be watching this motion, because the planets are doing that all the time, but it takes weeks of motion to see, especially with something slow like Saturn, which creeps along there. But Mars moves pretty fast, and here it's going to be a nice illustration of the westward, rather the eastward, orbital motion of Mars in particular.
Cool. We have, Tom, are you going to add something there?
There's, I think, another good one that's on August 18th, which I only get to remember because it's my mother's 90th birthday. Happy birthday, Ma. No, it's Jupiter and Venus are going to be in the morning sky.
That's right.
And they're going to be extremely close, if I remember the numbers right, within a half a degree. And that would be something you could see both in a telescope field of view. And at very early, however, you have to get up in the morning.
Yeah, pre-dawn, right?
Which I'm not as much into anymore. I can stay out for the late night ones, but getting back up for the morning one, that's a little tougher. But it looks like that would be a great one.
I'm the morning guy now. I'm usually up around 4:30 or so, and I'm out doing my jog in the morning. So,
well,
I've always have my phone with me, and there'll be times when I'll stop and, what is that? And then I'll go to my app and, that's what it is. Yeah. And then continue on.
They'll rise just before the sun then, Larry. You're all set if that's it.
Oh, perfect. And that's what day?
August 18th.
I will look forward to that. Dennis and Ogdenburg, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. See, this isn't about the sky, but it's about binoculars, which you were just talking about.
Yeah.
When I buy binoculars and look at them, they always have those two numbers, 10 by 40, 30 by 70, whatever. I don't understand what those numbers refer to, and the problem I have is I don't know. I mostly use them for looking at birds in my yard, not long-distance things, not looking at the sky, and I never can decide what's the appropriate pair of numbers to use for that type of viewing.
Well, they're easier than you think,
good.
And this will help. The first number is always the magnification, the number of times you're increasing the size of your object you're looking at.
Okay.
Good numbers for bird watching, usually 8 power. By the time you start hitting 10 power for the first number, they get more difficult to hold. Astronomers will mount them on things to keep them steady enough, even at 10 power.
Shaking in your hands.
Exactly. Yeah. So the 8 helps with that. And even 6 power, if you find a pair to test that you like to go down with that, that's fine for bird watching, especially for backyard. The second number is just the size of the front lens. Size of the front lens in millimeters. So it's telling you how much light you're gathering. And the larger you can get that number, the brighter they'll be under low light situations. So for astronomy, you like to have a big number for the second one. For bird watching, you like to have a significant number, at least, for the second one, because you use them a lot at dawn or dusk.
Oh, and the birds are always in the shadows.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a little more activity around then. So a good 8 by 40 is a good all-around birding binocular.
All right. So that second number is just the measure of the lens itself.
Exactly.
Does that indicate how big of an area you will see, or does it just indicate how much light comes in?
It indicates how much light.
Do you get a bigger view?
The field of view would be a third number if they print it on the bino, or it'll be in the specs of the binocular itself. And they'll express that usually in degrees. If you think of a pie sitting in front of you, it's the slice that you see out ahead of you. They may express it in feet at 1,000 yards. They're just telling you how wide the pie is, you know, out at the crust at the end of your field of view there. That's just another way of expressing it. There, I wouldn't worry quite so much about the field of view. The quality of the glass, you know, you hope to try to get up into a certain range where you can buy something that's, you know, well put together, has good glass. They'll all have a good field of view if they're marketing them as birding binoculars.
Yeah, well, the places I go, they're not really marketing them that way. They just have dozens of binoculars with all different numbers on them. And
sure.
You look through them, and they all look like they magnify, but it's hard to... The idea about the eliminating the shake is good. I like that. Makes me understand that first number. Is there a distinction in your minds between adjustable and non-adjusting glasses?
I mean,
there's some that you don't have to... They just are automatically in.
Oh, permanent focus or permafocus?
Yes.
Yeah, that helps you pick some binoculars because you don't want to pick those. that's a short way of putting it. But no, the problem with that is they try to make it all things to all people, but they end up making it for about half the population to view at 50 feet. If you get my drift, they're not adjustable enough to work, say, with your eye correction or your eyeglasses or, you know, anything else. You want to try to get a sharp image because you're trying to hit identifying marks or. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, get the sharpest image you can out of them. You'll definitely want a binocular with focus. One other thing I might have asked you was, do you wear eyeglasses?
Yes, I do.
There's an adjustability at the eyepiece that you might look into, and that's how you can set the eye cups.
I tend to not use my glasses when I use a binocular.
Sure.
And then I just adjust the lenses with a plus or minus to balance the eyes.
Sure, and then you wouldn't be able to use the permafocus ones at all because you won't be making the other correction for your eyeglass correction.
Yeah, so don't do that.
There you go.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Dennis. Appreciate your call. Boy, now there's some questions I'll bet a lot of people had.
Oh, everybody has those. Yeah, you got to start from how they're going to work for you.
Yeah, it was great questions. Dan in Cronenwater, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey there. I got a quick question. I'm a science teacher at a very small little high school. We have an Odyssey 8 refractor, great big red tube, and it's mounted on an altitude azimuth-type base where it just swivels around, you know, just chunks of plywood.
Sure.
Which works very nicely, but if I really want to find something like anything deep sky, I've got a finder on it. But it would really be nice if there was some kind of a dial for at least declination where I could at least dial something in. And I've been dinking around with trying to put like protractors on it or levels on it. Just wondering if there's any kind of kits available or some way of at least coming to within a degree or two of declination using that thing so I don't have to spend so much time star hopping.
Tom Hall, what do you think?
Well, they do make some aftermarket kits that will give you essentially setting circles, even in altitude and azimuth. But I'm going to say if you're a school teacher trying to work within a budget, it might be hard because some of these cost more than the scope might have cost
right.
you for an Odyssey 8-inch Dobsonian. We do love that style of scope. You've probably been able to use it pretty well with students because they're so stable. They
right.
do gather enough light for it. But boy, I think you might want to try hitting one of your amateur astronomy societies because a lot of those people may have already worked with that or can give you a better source than I about where they ran across some, you know, setting circles that you might have been able to add on or use that aren't electronic. The electronic ones work really well, but you'll end up spending a bit to try to get them. The advantage to the electronic ones, though, might be that you'd also get a star catalog built in to the system itself. It would help you find some of those deep sky objects, you know, just because you'd be able to point at them and they'd be within the database itself and you can read it in the dark, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, another possibility you might think about, depending on what your budget is maybe improving your finder. But it, when you say you have a finder on it, do you mean there's a little telescope attached to the big telescope?
I've got a Telrad on there.
Oh, you do have a Telrad. Okay.
Yep.
Well, that's what I was going to suggest was what they call a reflex finder. There's a number of them on the market, and those are
concentric circles. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're a lot handier to use than looking through an actual little finder telescope. So you can. I almost never use setting circles, and I've got a fairly good list of deep sky objects that I can point to by what they call star hopping. We all right. used to learn little tricks for finding things in the sky, and a reflex finder is great for that. You learn that you look over at this star, and then you look just to the right to that star and go down a little bit, and then you're there, or something mm-hmm. like that. So you can get a long way without the electronics, but the electronics is great if you can manage it.
Mm-hmm. There are apps for your smart device. If you've got a tablet or a phone,
sure.
There's an app called Star Walk, literally just star and walk, two words. And that one, I think, could help quite a bit because you'd be able to get a screen size that shows you the surrounding areas. You'd be able to do, like Jim has suggested here, walk over to the section you're trying to hit. And the neat thing about those is you can kind of hold them up to the sky and get the proper orientation, unlike, say, a paper chart, which was always a lot harder to do.
Yeah.
And you had to have a kind of a talent for that. But these really do present the sky almost as you'll see them if you get the right orientation.
Cool. Okay. All cool things to try. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Good luck.
And I liked your idea about the organizations, too, the local clubs. I'd bet anything, Dan, if he can find a local club, he'd probably find people who would be more than happy to help or donate or of their time or talents.
We just ran across a very nice page that was organized by a man named Jeff Setzer, who I think is one of the Milwaukee Club members. It's called WisconsinAstronomy.org. So go right to that website. Jim and I both learned that there are many more astronomy clubs in Wisconsin than we would have thought. This gentleman will list 17 of them. So
wow.
There's clubs in Racine, there's clubs in New Berlin, there's clubs in Dodgeville, Prairie du Chien, you know, up north, you name it. They're in Grafton, they're in, you know, the Green Bay area. So I would try that page. They also have nice events and star parties that he has listed there. Looks like a really nice resource that he's keeping up for that. WisconsinAstronomy.org.
WisconsinAstronomy.org. Okay.
Yeah, the clubs are often a pool of unexpected expertise. I mean, they often have guys in there who know a lot.
Yeah.
And they're hobbyists, so they've often fiddled around with a lot of different options for telescopes. They know the good stuff.
We have, by the way, you can join in, too. With some open lines, we'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page, post a question or even a star photo there at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Jan went on my Facebook page and said, I grew up in Chicago and like to stargaze and identify constellations. I now live in northern Wisconsin and love being able to see the Milky Way, the meteors at times, and watch the ISS, International Space Station, pass over.
Yeah, you can. My mother-in-law has become an International Space Station fan. She goes out to see it every time it flies over Rochester, Minnesota. She goes over to see it and then sends me an email. I just saw the space station fly over. You can see that from Chicago, but the Milky Way you will never see from
Chicago.
Nope, northern Wisconsin. Or just out, you don't have to be in northern Wisconsin, but northern Wisconsin's a great place to get a dark sky.
Where do you see the International Space Station? Now, some probably people are saying, well, now where am I going to see that?
Well, actually, it flies over many times a day, but most of them are in the daytime. And then most of them at night, it's not being illuminated by the sun. The space station's not really all that far away. It's not much farther away than Chicago if you could drive straight up when it flies overhead. So it has to be illuminated by the sun. So you see it. The visible passes are the ones just before dawn and just after dusk. And there are a couple of good ways to find out when there's going to be a visible one. The best one, there's a bunch of apps,
uh-huh.
of course. But the website that I like to recommend is called heavensabove.org, or is it .com?
.com.
.com. I believe it's heavens-above.com. Yeah, heavens-above.com. And you go there and you tell it where you live, and I think the ISS might even be sort of a default choice there, but it'll give you predictions for all kinds of satellites, so it's more than you imagine orbiting around there. It'll tell you what's going to be flying over and what you can get predictions for, like the next day or the next week or whatever.
Brian and Marinette up next. Hi, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Well, the question I have is, you know, my wife and I both went to UW-Madison, and we walked up over Observatory Hill many times. And then you go down to Lake Geneva, and there's an old observatory there. I imagine both of those are useless with all the light pollution from Milwaukee, Chicago, and all the rest. Are there any decent terrestrial locations where the light pollution doesn't interfere with real decent sky watching?
Well, it sort of depends on what you want to do. I mean, it's true that you're talking about Yerkes Observatory on Lake Geneva and right. the Washburn Observatory here on the UW campus. And it's true that no astronomical research is done at either one of those locations anymore, although Yerkes, they managed to keep doing research until fairly recently. But yes, the sky quality is so bad. And also, it's not only the sky. Those instruments are too small for modern research.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're, yeah, research, that's why all the research observatories are out in, you know, in the middle of Arizona or New Mexico or Chile or places like that. So no, I don't think you would do much research around here. There's also the climate, you know, it's clearer more often in Arizona than it is here too. So there are various things that drive professional research in directions, but there are plenty of great places for stargazing, for amateur stargazing. Really all you've got to do, even around Madison, if you drive 20, 30 miles in the right direction, you'll find dark skies. And for amateur stargazing, that's plenty. And there's some skies in northern Wisconsin that are probably as dark as New Mexico on a good night.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And by the way, I mean, I've been to the UW Space Place in the evening and participated in some of your events. All right, so there's some light out there, but they're a lot of fun, and you get to see a lot.
That's right. We do what we think of as urban astronomy. There's plenty of bright objects that, you know, we can't look at. We can't even see the Milky Way from Space Place, but we can see the planets. We can see bright stars, binary stars, star clusters. There's a lot of stuff that you can see even in a light-polluted environment, so it's not impossible to get in some astronomy almost anywhere.
What's going on at the Space Place these days, by the way?
Well, so I guess coming up in the near future, we've got two guest speakers coming up here pretty soon. We have one on the second Tuesday in August, and let me just make sure I get the date right on that one. It's the second Tuesday in August. Is August 12th. There we go. Mm-hmm. We have a public talk there from a researcher, a UW researcher who works on cosmic rays. She's going to tell us about what we can learn about the universe from cosmic rays at 7 p.m. And then we've got another interesting one coming up in September on the second Tuesday in September, which I think is the 9th, is it?
Mm-hmm.
We have Professor Kaplan from UW-Milwaukee, who's just been involved in a really interesting discovery, a white dwarf star that is probably, as they keep describing it, a diamond. It's the coolest. It's actually that it's the coolest known, coolest in the temperature sense, also pretty cool in another sense, white dwarf star. And white dwarfs are largely a burnt-out core of a star that are mostly carbon and oxygen. So they call it the diamond star. If it cools down and crystallizes enough, you'd have a huge diamond there. So he's going to tell us about that recent discovery at Space Place also. So all those things are, of course, on our website at spaceplace.org.
Mm. And what's going on at Eagle Optics these days, Tom?
Boy, there's always new products that these days I have a hard time trying to keep up with, especially from the astronomical companies. Having a hard time trying to keep up with things. And even, you know, the German equipment manufacturers like Leica or Swarovski, you know, keep coming up with terrific new equipment that might not be in everybody's budget, for instance,
yeah.
for those guys. But we certainly try to come out with more economical stuff. We have an astronomical binocular that we just came out with that's a 7x50, $289 and individual focus. And it's built for boating also, so comes in a 10x50 model. There's new developments all over. The big manufacturers, Celestron and Mead, of course, it's hard to even describe how advanced their telescopes are these days.
You know, what is worrisome a little bit is that I've seen some of the products on the lowest end are really not even worth the small amount of money you're paying for them.
Boy, you can say that again. Sometimes those things, I worry that people get them and then get frustrated with them, and they're, you know, they start out enthusiastic about astronomy, but if the instrument is off telescopes for the most part, is so hard to use or just not really usable because it's poorly designed, then people go away unhappy with that. And so that's a waste of money and worse, a waste of interest and enthusiasm.
Absolutely. So, Tom, if you're looking at a telescope, is there a price point where you say, okay, at this price, I can be reasonably assured I've got something that's decent?
Sure. As our educator called in with earlier, the Dobsonian telescope that he had that was 8 inches in diameter, you can get, and I think both Jim and I like the 6-inch size, if you can get into that in a reflector, you can get those for under $390. Okay. You can find a fairly decent kit for under $300, I think. And you do a little more of the assembly yourself. But no, Orion Instruments out of California has 6-inch Dobsonians, under $400. Nice stable mounts. Easy for the kids to use that way. You get them to hold their hands behind their back and not grab the eyepiece like they'll always try to do. But the less expensive refractors, Jim commented on one that he'd just seen at Space Place. If they're under $120 or those sort of things, the mounts are so shaky, so poorly machined. Boy, you can't recommend those. So I would try to look in at least that 300 range if you can. Find a nice stable tripod if you like the refracting style, something smaller. And again, you can get in for under $300 for a fairly decent scope.
And you probably, when you're at that level, the value probably holds up fairly well, too.
Oh, certainly. Those are instruments that, your kids will end up using when you're done with them and they're sat in the garage for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They'll still work just fine 20 years down the road, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is... Oh, great. Let's take one more question. Claire in Baraboo, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I like to watch for satellites at night. A friend showed me that a couple years ago, and I was just astounded how many I could spot. But my question is, I assume they fly higher in the sky than jets or planes do.
Sure.
And do they all go in the same direction around the planet?
No. So you find satellites. It depends on the type of satellite. The relatively low ones, like the International Space Station, for example, are always going, in some sense, west to east, because they launch them that way because you get a little bit of an energy boost from the Earth's motion. So a lot of them go that way. Those are in fairly short period orbits. It only takes about 90 minutes for them to go around. There's a whole other category of satellites that a lot of meteorological satellites are in polar orbits, and they go basically north to south, and they're often in higher orbits. The communication satellites, which you'll never see, the synchronous satellites are way out there, like 23,000 miles out or something like that, and they have a very long orbital period, 24 hours. That's why they put them out there, is because then they appear to hover over a place, and you can point your antenna, and you don't have to track them. They just stay there. So there's all kinds in between. So there's a huge variety of altitudes and orbital inclinations and applications.
Thank you for calling. It's a great question, Claire. And Jim and Tom, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew.
Certainly did. Always a pleasure.
I hope you'll come back and be with us again soon. We got to do this again this summer.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you so much. Jim Lattice, faculty associate in the astronomy department at UW-Madison, director of the UW Space Place, and Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. And, of course, both these business or organizations have websites, and we have links to them on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show if you want to learn more about either one. And I hope you do, because they're good places. We are going to switch gears a bit. Always great to be reminded to stand still and take a look up at the sky. And one of the best places to do that, as we've talked about, the North Woods of Wisconsin.